So, is there anybody in the room who's ever done any work with jail or prison healthcare? Dr. Jonathan Weisbuck, an old friend and colleague who actually talked me into to being here, he was going to give some background on correctional health, and I feel like I should do that before getting into my present talk. Excuse me. So, Dr. Weisbuck worked in the Massachusetts corrections system, I believe, back in the 1970s, and had gone on to work in correctional systems in Wyoming, South Dakota, and in Maricopa County. So he had a good overview and a good historical perspective. And as you heard in the introduction, I've been the CEO of the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare for 20 years now, which is a long time. Actually, I'm going to retire in 2014. But let me give you an overview, and it looks like a pretty young crowd. Are there any film buffs in the audience? If I said movies like Cool Hand Luke, would you know what I'm talking about? Or how about Dog Day Afternoon, an Al Pacino classic? In one scene in Dog Day Afternoon, Al Pacino, in the process of trying to rob a bank and holding hostages, goes out into the street, and there's a crowd that's cheering him for whatever reason, and he starts shouting, "Attica, Attica!" 1971 was a seminal period in our nation's history when it comes to corrections and correctional health. There was a riot in Attica State Prison in New York that was televised on TV, and I don't believe that had happened before. And with the social consciousness that was around from the 60s and black power and other trends that were going on, it really captivated the nation. We saw it on black and white TV. It lasted, I think, a few days. The governor of the state, Governor Rockefeller, came down with a megaphone and was shouting inside. And it turned out there was a very bloody result. But it did get the attention of the nation to think about, well, what's going on behind bars? Up until that point, I think, for most people, what was going on in prisons and jails, they didn't want to think about, didn't want to talk about. And in fact, it was the domain of the people running the correctional system. In 1976, there was a landmark Supreme Court decision called Estelle v. Gamble, where the Supreme Court said, when society incarcerates a person and takes away his or her freedoms, society is obligated to provide necessary food, necessary shelter, and necessary health care. And so since 76, inmates have been one of the few classes of Americans, if not only, that were guaranteed a right to health care. What trendsetters? We've been in corrections. As soon as that happened, there was a lot of lawsuits filed all over the country. I should move off this slide, I suppose. I don't have any disclosures, by the way, wherever that was. There were a lot of lawsuits and other things to affect change. The American Medical Association did a study of healthcare in jails and found that most jails in the country didn't provide any healthcare whatsoever. And those that did only provided first aid, or the majority of them did. Now, I have to interrupt here to explain the difference between jails and prisons. And these slides don't follow. These are the organizations that sit on my board of directors, including APHA and other groups, if you can see things that small. I have a large board that I report to, 38 people. But the AMA, the Dental Association, Psychiatric Association, the Bar Association, NACO, NACHO, I've got a good alphabet soup. Jails, house, so jails are run by city and county governments, and they house people primarily who are awaiting trial, haven't been convicted primarily of anything. By the way, I take a cue from my friends in public health departments. Once you've seen one jail, you've seen one jail. So I'm going to talk in generalities, but there's a wide variety of activities in jails and in prisons and in juvenile systems as well. So someone could be arrested on a DUI or picked up on suspicion of something, and until they make bail or sober up, they're going to be housed in jail. So it might be a day, might be 2 days, it could be up to a year, sometimes even more. But the average stay in a jail is, it keeps on growing, but it's about 2 months. In prisons, prisons are run by state and federal government. And I'll turn off my hands, thank you. These house people who have been convicted. So they're going to be incarcerated for years, sometimes for the rest of their lives. On average, someone is in prison for 2 years or more. So the health profile of someone coming in off the street, oftentimes with a substance use problem that has led to their being picked up, is much different than a person who's going to prison who's already been in jail, has stood trial, perhaps was out on bond, but has had more of a chance to prepare and clean themselves. So by the time they get to prison there, it's just a different profile of patient. And I was very interested with a prior speaker about using performance measures, which NCCHC does, but we have to adapt because the person coming into a jail to start, you know, to find the base level of hemoglobin A1C or something is just going to be different. For these people are coming in and out sometimes in a day or 24 hours. Jails and prisons house people that they haven't asked for, and in the case of jails in particular, had no sense that these many people were coming through the door. In healthcare, healthcare is operating within somebody else's house. So most jails are run by sheriffs, the county jails. Most state prisons are run by a secretary of corrections. And even though healthcare has become one of the biggest parts of their budgets, it's not the purpose that that correctional facility exists. And so the orientation, oftentimes, of the people in charge is, first and foremost, we're going to protect, we're going to secure these people, we're going to do things. On the health side, and we've seen a lot of changes in healthcare over the years, we take a patient approach. NCCHC standards, so these are our patients. We have to advocate for our patients, and we have to work with custody at the same time. So I asked about films and history and your interaction. There are lots, let's see, there's 3,000 correctional facilities in the country. I take that back. There's 3,000 jails, and there's probably about another 1,500 or 2,000 prisons and juvenile sites. So we have a lot of places. We incarcerate as a country about 3 million people on any day. And over the course of a year with the releases and everything else, we release to the community about 12 million people per year. There's a wonderful public health opportunity. There are many people who come through, I'll say, our doors who have illnesses that they are unaware of. And as many of you probably have heard, when we come to mental health issues, we are not only the last resort, oftentimes the first resort that we have. We have a great burden of mental illness in our correctional systems because we don't provide good treatment in the community. For those of you who have heard that prisons or jails are a breeding ground of violence and rape and HIV and infectious disease. It just simply isn't true. We do get a lot of people who come in with disease that has been undiagnosed or underdiagnosed and are able to initiate therapies and provide treatment that otherwise that person probably would not get. So I can go on and on about the historical perspective, but it's sort of a fascinating field, and I wouldn't have been doing it for all these years if it were easy, if it were not challenging and interesting, and if we haven't been seeing improvement. So we have established standards, and the standards are, as it says here, outcome-based and evidence-driven, as well as consensus-driven, and they're informed by best practices. What goes on in your local jail or prison is probably not exactly what goes on someplace else. We all read the headlines, and the headlines get attention, but it is not typical. We do have some of the finest physicians and nurses and public health professionals in our systems around the country. Some jails and prisons contract out their health services to a university or a health department or to a private company. Some do it on their own. So it's just a world of change. I'll speak briefly about the California experience. California had the largest prison system, not only in the U.S., but in the world. And terrible overcrowding, and they had lost a lawsuit, a number of suits, over the years. And finally, the federal courts said, you know, you keep losing these suits and say you're going to change, but you haven't changed enough. And so the federal court actually took over and said, we are going to tell you how much you're going to spend, and we're going to give you the rules you have to follow. And it's an enormously expensive result of not complying and doing things the proper way 30 years earlier when they first got found out to have inadequate health care. But now, at least under the court receiver, they've made tremendous progress. Certainly there are still problems, but we have advantages in correctional health care that you don't find in hospitals, that you don't find in the community. For one, we have pretty good access to our patients. We can initiate treatment and follow up on that treatment the community just doesn't have that same type of access. And these are often high-risk patients. Poverty is prevalent in the community, but again, I'll caution, not everyone in jail or prison is poor. We've had bad outcomes with when custody staff or the arresting officers have assumed somebody is a poor drunk and somehow their lives aren't as valuable, perhaps, or they don't take the care that they should, but it turns out to be a university regent or gubernatorial appointee. I have a friend, I had a friend who passed away, who was the medical director at the L.A. County Jail, and his story always was he was the doctor to the stars, because he would get the infamous Hollywood whomever who got into trouble and ended up being in jail, and so he, you know, his issues often were not providing health care, but providing people a way so that the person could have privacy, and even the custody officers and others were seeking autographs. So I'm going to move through quickly here. NCCHC came about as a part of a program in the AMA in the 70s. We became incorporated in 1983. I joined the staff in a few years after that and became the president in 93. the standards that we put out there, these are voluntary. There's not too much incentive. Even in the Affordable Care Act, I remember hearing a story from a fellow at NACO, the Association of Counties, as he sat in the room when Congress went through line by... Oh, that's my time. Okay, good. And cut out the... I silenced this. All right. I won't take too much time, but they cut out corrections because we are sort of the poor stepchild. Politicians don't want to be seen as soft on crime, and they see health care to inmates as a benefit. And the federal government says, well, if the courts are require that states and counties provide health care, we don't want to pick up that burden, so we're going to exclude anything for inmates, and we don't want to be seen as soft on crime. So there are 60,000 health care professionals working in our jails and prisons every day, often without the recognition and the respect for the hard work that they do, and that's a big effort of us to try to improve. Let me go through quickly. Guidelines for disease management, lots of good diseases. We have position statements on the website you're welcome to take a look at. This is my email address. Feel free to contact me, and I'll be around for questions afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you.